Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So before we get rolling, I'm going to talk a little bit about listerosis as one of our top stories. We've got emails. We'll be going to your calls. And of course, the reason that we're leading with listeria is because we've got an issue right now in the country, right? We had the listeria cantaloupe incident a few days ago. And recently, we've had a lettuce recall from one of our local farms. Truly Farms of Salinas recalled about 90 cartons of listeria after one tested positive on a spot check by the FDA. And I do love those FDA spot checks. I'm very grateful, and you simply cannot ever really trust the food supply completely. It's a trust but verify situation. And once you find an issue, because of our industrial food management and the way things get amplified, you kind of have to pull the whole batch. And that's what happened with the True Leaf Farms romaine lettuce. I want to emphasize no one got sick from that one. However, a number of people got very sick from cantaloupe. And that is still going to kind of work its way through the system, because listeria is a very interesting bug, quite different from, say, the usual sorts of food poisoning that one thinks about, like, oh, say, salmonella or staph food poisoning. Now, salmonella is a bacteria, and it gets into foods, eggs and chicken being the most common sources, and then is ingested alive, has a thick coat, gets through the stomach acid. Obviously, people who don't make stomach acid or people who are on protein pump inhibitors can get infected a lot more easily. Once in the intestine, it thrives, it multiplies, it goes forth and creates an illness that leads to diarrhea, and sometimes it actually invades the bowel wall and causes dysentery, which is blood and mucus as well as diarrhea, and can get into the bloodstream and actually cause death. That's salmonella. The other common one we see a lot is staph food poisoning, completely different. Staph actually grows in the food and elaborates a toxin. This toxin then makes you sick very quickly, almost immediately. Now, listeria, which is the one we're going to be talking about in a little more depth, is a fascinating bug. It actually, in the environment, is flagellated, so it can swim around. Once it gets into a human by ingestion, there's a very long delay. The incubation period for listeria is up to 4 weeks, quite unusual, and that makes tracing an epidemic like this very difficult. In the case of the cantaloupe, as you think about a cantaloupe, it's got that lovely rough surface that is a little bit irregular, and that's a lovely place for bacteria to just kind of hang out and hide. It's unusual for listeria to come through in vegetables or fruits. It's been more common lately, however. We used to think of listeria as being primarily something that comes through in milk and cheese products. But anyway, we're dealing with this current epidemic. Once inside your body, the listeria actually gets into the white blood cells, and it hijacks something like a virus. It actually hijacks the cellular machinery. Now, the white blood cells encapsulate the listeria. Listeria seeks them out. The white blood cells say, oh, you're a bacteria. They engulf it, and they attempt to phagocytize it. That means it makes a bubble of cell membrane around the bug and takes it into itself, and then it has these lysosomes, which are basically really nasty acids and enzymes and things that dissolve bugs on contact, right? So before the lysosomes can dump into the vacuole, the listeria has a secret weapon, a little, essentially a chemical knife that it uses to open up the lysosome and escape into the cell. Once in the cell, it's along for the ride, and it goes everywhere white blood cells do, which means, of course, everywhere, including into the central nervous system. And one of the reasons that people die of listeriosis is because it gets into their brain and causes meningitis and encephalitis. So it's an extremely nasty bug. Now, it does respond to antibiotics, but first you have to figure out that this person who comes in a month, let's say, because those cantaloupes are still out there. So by the end of October, we'll be past the month or two where most of the cases will emerge. And this person with fever and maybe a history of some diarrhea a week or two ago, who now has fever and body aches, and I might add, we're getting into flu season, so the possibility of misdiagnosis is very high. So what I would say about this is that we cannot have a completely safe food supply. I like to see us use more data farming. For example, social networking tools and Google searches can give you a lot of information. And Google has, I just recently attended a conference, they were doing research looking at, okay, what's the incidence of flu and what's the flu rate doing? And they were collaborating with the CDC to show that before the flu hits a community, the number of searches for upper respiratory infection, persistent cough, body aches, fever as keyword searches skyrockets. And that happens before people start showing up in the doctor's office and before the tests for the influenza start showing up and notifying the CDC that, yes, we have a flu outbreak. So we may be able, using just searches that have been de-identified from any personal info, we may be able to use that to get early warning signals. So, for example, if we start seeing that sort of thing with a diarrheal keyword search, then we can worry that we might have a little epidemic going. It's an interesting use of this new technology. And just to paraphrase a little bit about this, there is a brave new world out there in terms of the social networks, in terms of the internet searches. And because we have such vast computing power also on the web, we can sort of take a kind of community vital sign in a way that hasn't existed before. And we're just becoming aware that this possibility exists. And people have been thinking very hard about how can we use this in epidemiology? How can we use this to help improve the public health? And I think there's some interesting and provocative ideas there. And I'll be sure to keep you informed because I'm extremely excited about the possibilities of this internet data mining, shall we call it. Let's go to our first email, and that is from Andre in Santa Cruz. I wanted to be sure that I put this one out there right away. Andre says, I was diagnosed with an amelanotic tumor on my leg. The doctor wants to remove the melanoma, the surgeon, that is 0.8 millimeters and do a sentinel node biopsy using a radioactive tracer and a blue dye. He also recommended seeing a plastic surgeon for a skin graft since he wants to make about a 3-inch in length and 1.5-inch wide incision. This is quite a shock to me because the melanoma is so small. So the question that Andre asks is, do I really need a sentinel node biopsy? Let's talk about melanoma for a moment because it is a, first of all, very lucky thing that this lesion was biopsied. Since it was amelanotic, that means it's a melanoma, but the cancer is so sick in terms of its own DNA that it doesn't even make melanin. But the cells, the root cells, are the melanin-producing cells. So that's what an amelanotic melanoma is. And those are very difficult to spot because they're not dark, so they're hard to see. So bravo to the doctor who did the biopsy. Secondly, what's really important is both the width and the depth of the lesion. Usually we say if its depth is less than a millimeter, then you don't have to do a full workup looking for metastasis. But in the case of this kind of melanoma, because it tends to be more aggressive, those rules for melanoma kind of go out the window. And yes, Andre, I think you do need absolutely every diagnostic thing in the book because we need to find out whether this has the potential to have escaped. This is an extremely aggressive cancer if it gets out of your skin and gets in even to a lymph node. So finding that lymph node and removing it, if it's there, is key. The alternative would just be to go to full-on chemotherapy, assuming that it's already escaped. And I think you have a chance to avoid that. So, you know, stay with the program here. I am very much in favor of you getting the full court press on this. Let's go to our first caller, and that is Larry from Atlanta. Hello, Larry, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Owen. Thank you so much. I wanted to call you back as a follow-up from our last conversation. When I spoke to you, I told you about the rectal examination I had. Well, since I last spoke to you, I had my PSA results back.
Okay.
And the results were 0.75, which is on the low side. Now, I can say also that over the past couple of years, I've gone to community health center affairs and had PSA tests, not regular examination, PSA tests, and those tests were also on the low end, too. My first question is having nodules on my prostate and having a low PSA score, is that some kind of anomaly, or what do you think about that condition?
Well, first of all, for the audience, Larry called in last week having just had a rectal exam where nodules were found, and he was looking for some information.
Yes.
So the good news is that a low PSA is generally a good prognosis indicator, meaning that maybe you don't have cancer, maybe these nodules are not cancerous. The bad news is sometimes it's exactly the opposite. I was just talking about the amelanotic melanoma for that person who emailed me with a question. Well, the same thing is true of prostate cancer. Sometimes prostate cancers are so messed up in terms of their own genetics that they lose the ability to elaborate PSA, which is a protein. So they've stopped making the protein. Anytime a cancer is that mixed up and crazy, you tend to have a more aggressive cancer. So it's like it's good news unless it's very, very bad news. What is really important now is, did you get the biopsy?
Good question. Okay, not yet. I guess that's the next thing I've got to do. The hospital where I have the PSA examination suggested that I see a urologist.
Right. You want a finger that has felt hundreds of prostate cancers feeling your prostate. Now, I've probably felt in the course of my career that I knew about that turned out to be cancers in 20 years, maybe three. I mean, you think of prostate cancer as being so common, but because we catch it early, it's not unusual for someone like myself to not really ever feel them. If I'm screening my population properly, I should catch it before it can be palpable. Same thing for mammograms, right? When we do a mammogram, we find a breast cancer 5 years before you can feel that breast cancer on the average. That's an important distinction to make. But maybe it's not a prostate cancer. I mean, this was a primary care provider like myself who may not have felt that many cancers. And any time I feel a nodule, I'm going to treat it as if it were a prostate cancer. But, you know, sometimes people have lumps that aren't nodules. So I'm hoping that this turns out just to be a false alarm. Go get that urological exam. Men need to be less shy about their rectums. I'm just going to put that out there. You know, it's not a big deal. It doesn't hurt. The reason that men, I think, have this phobia, and men do, by the way, have a phobia, and I include doctors. Doctors themselves male doctors don't do enough rectal exams on men because everybody's got this homophobia thing where they're afraid that, you know, the guy's going to think I'm gay for wanting to do a rectal exam. And I mean, they really have to kind of push themselves to do a rectal exam. And I see that in emergency room physicians where a person comes in with belly pain. I mean, I'm sorry, but if someone has belly pain, even if it's upper abdomen, you should do a rectal exam. I mean, take no prisoners. Always do a rectal exam. I see that being dropped all the time, and I know it's wrong, but I also know that it's coming from this, well, I really don't want to be embarrassed to ask the person, and the person's not going to know why I want to do it, so they're going to think I'm gay. And the guys are like, well, it's kind of a bad thing to have. It's sort of gay-like to have somebody put their finger in your rectum. And, I mean, we just need to get over that, guys. Maybe now that things have relaxed and there's no longer quite as much prejudice and antipathy, although there's still quite a lot of hate crimes going on, I think it's starting to actually be uncool to put people down if they have a different sexual orientation. Eventually, that can be uncool as calling someone the N-word if they're African-American. At that point, I think maybe we get over this thing about rectal exams, but we're looking at another generation. I really want to wish you good luck here, okay?
Can I ask you a question about the biopsy?
Go ahead.
Okay. I understand there are biopsies and biopsies. You know, there's the old-fashioned with a needle, the surgical kind. But I also heard a podcast about another kind of biopsy, which I understand was approved by the FDA. It's something to do with testing the urine. Have you heard anything about that? And also, too, what do you think of the idea of having a sonogram?
I think you'll get the sonogram when you go to the urologist.
Okay.
I think that because you have nodules that are palpable, they'll be very easy to biopsy.
Okay, good.
And so this distinction for you which is great, is when someone shows up with a high PSA and a low percentage free PSA, which is a bad prognostic marker for a high PSA being an actual cancer, and we can't feel a nodule, well, then we end up having to do kind of a blind sampling of, you know, usually 12 different passes with a needle through the prostate, hoping that we hit the tumor and knowing we might miss. On the other hand, if we've got a nodule, and that's the whole reason we're chasing this, all we have to do with a PSA that low is check those nodules.
Good.
And make sure those nodules don't have a problem. So that's a much less aggressive thing that you have to have done. And as far as the checking the urine thing, I'm not familiar with it. I will search on it, and if I think it's a legitimate technology, I'll be back in the next few weeks with information about it. But overall, I would say that my initial take on it is you've got something that's going to be easy to get at. Just go for it. You know, get over the rectum thing. This is not a big deal. You'll be fine.
Right.
You're not going to have a major complication. You know, get this over with and get on with life.
Good advice. Thank you, Dawn.
All right.
Thank
you very much for your call, Larry. Bye-bye. Interesting email from Reshma in Jersey City. I was wondering if I could ask a question about my husband's problem. He has a skipping heartbeat and thinks it's related to his diet. But as soon as he uses the bathroom, the skipping reduces and sometimes goes away. His gastroenterologist and heart specialist say digestion and heart palpitations are not usually connected. My husband's getting depressed and frustrated because they can't find his problem. His gastro doc says he has mild Crohn's disease in his lower intestine is inflamed. Husband thinks that even when his food passes through his intestines, something, perhaps bacteria, is getting into his bloodstream and causing the palpitations. We're trying to control his diet, no gluten, and he's on Cipro. Can you shed some light? Well, I wanted to say, Reshma, that my first thought was that the most likely thing here, as far as your husband's having his palpitations reduce when he uses the bathroom, in other words, when he defecates, is a reflex. This reflex is part of your autonomic nervous system. This is the part of the nervous system that regulates the heartbeat and, guess what, also regulates the bowel. So there's an obvious connection there. And I'm surprised that your doctors didn't think of it. But then again, I'm not surprised because you asked two specialists. And by definition, specialists stay on their turf and they don't think outside of their voluntary little box. Doctors need to use their heads and not just their memories. So my proposal is that when your husband poops, what he's doing is he's bearing down. And we know that when you bear down, you increase your parasympathetic tone. Parasympathetic tone, by the way, slows the heart rate and would reduce palpitations because it has a calming effect on the heart. So there's an obvious reflex reason why this might be true. If he has Crohn's disease, then he certainly does have a permeability barrier, and he could have toxins being absorbed into his bloodstream. He could also he's also much more likely to have food sensitivities and food antibody issues because undigested fragments are being exposed to the immune system, and the immune system is upregulated in the first place. This may be triggering an inflammatory response. In fact, it probably is. That itself can be irritating to the heart muscle and could all by itself lead to increased palpitations or extra beats, ventricular irritability. So I think that there's a very good reason that all of this is connected. And of course it's connected. It's all happening in the same body. So how could it not be connected? We had another email from Keith in Santa Cruz. Keith wants to know why not neomycin. I had mentioned in an earlier program that I don't recommend using neomycin on skin injuries. I recommend perhaps using polysporin or bacitracin or double antibiotic cream. Generics, just fine. But neomycin, which is what's in neosporin or the triple antibiotic creams, is an allergen. So people become sensitized to it. I see this, oh gosh, perhaps once a month, someone will come in with an infection that's not getting better. And in fact, the infection's fine, but what they've got now is they think they've got a cellulitis. What they've actually got is a dermatitis from the neomycin. So I see it far too often to want people to be using it routinely. And I do think that there are better products out there that work just as well without the downside complication risk. One more email. Jackie in Florida writes on bacterial overgrowth and intestinal hyperpermeability, multiple food and chemical sensitivity. This dovetails really nicely with that previous email from Reshma in Jersey City. what Jackie wants to know is, how many people have you healed from small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and intestinal hyperpermeability, leaky gut with sensitive gastrointestinal system? How many have you healed from multiple food sensitivity? How many have you helped with multiple chemical sensitivity? If someone had all of these, what would you do? Well, you know, the how many have I healed question, I can't actually answer that because I haven't been tracking the over 200 functional medicine patients I've seen since I opened my functional medicine practice. I haven't been tracking them by diagnosis, so I don't really have those numbers. I could go back in the charts and get it, but I didn't do it in terms of answering this question. So I'm going to focus on the what would you do? And when I have someone with all of the above, there are several assumptions, one of which is I assume that they've had some kind of mucosal injury. So I evaluate for gut permeability. Often I'll just do that by looking at food sensitivities, because food sensitivities, if there are a lot of them, imply that somehow undigested food fragments long enough to attract an immune system response are getting to those Peyer's patches in the gut. Let me give you my pop bead metaphor for this. You probably remember pop beads, the big ones that we still have for little kids. We used to have small ones, but then little kids started swallowing them. Little sister would swallow the pop beads, so those have kind of gone away. But, you know, large side beads that pop into each other and you can make a chain. It's a fun game. Well, when we digest protein, we break it down enzymatically. So we start out with a chain of perhaps 50 pop beads long, and we pull the pop beads apart at the red ones, and then we pull them apart at the green ones. And before you know it, you've got little two or three bead fragments, and those can be absorbed by the gastrointestinal system. And the GI tract, when it's healthy, doesn't let anything bigger than a one or two bead chain across. Now, the problem is that when the gastrointestinal system is not healthy, it does let longer chains across. And the immune system, if it's confronted with something that's, say, 10 amino acids long, it's capable of mounting an immune system response. Now, remember, I am simplifying this. This is a vastly complicated thing, but I'm kind of breaking it down to its real root fundamental mechanisms. So when a person says multiple chemical sensitivities, that usually means that their respiratory mucosa, their nose and their lungs, their throat, are also reactive. This is very common in people who are IgA deficient. So one of the first things I do is get an IgA level. In terms of treatment, there's something called the 4R protocols. You remove the things that are causing injury. You replace the gut flora with healthy gut flora, because there's almost always abnormal gut flora in that person. You re-inoculate with the positive gut flora, and you replace nutrients that the person might be missing, like primarily vitamin D, particularly if there's an autoimmune question. It's amazing how many people turn out to be insufficient in vitamin D. You restore gut functioning, and there are various things that we can do, various nutraceuticals that actually help improve gut permeability. And so one does all of these things. It's a holistic approach. It looks at all of the different systems of the body. And you also have to look for other toxins that might be present. And that's where this idea of mold toxins, of other types of toxins that might be even generated by bacteria in the intestine. It's all one big ecology. You, my friend, are a planet. And your planet has multiple microecologies and microclimates. And it doesn't always work well. Sometimes it's perturbed from the outside, sometimes from the inside. Sometimes well-meaning physicians perturb it, trying to fix one thing and not realizing that they might be missing something else in the process. So it's a complicated long-term process to fix or help someone. I wouldn't use the word I healed, because I don't heal anybody. At best, I midwife the healing that the body's capable of doing by nudging it in the right direction and removing barriers to healing that are in place and creating a persistent negative feedback loop. We had an off-air question. Does low testosterone protect against prostate cancer? The answer is, at least epidemiologically, no, it doesn't. There are a number of epidemiologic studies on this, and they show pretty consistently that the lower your testosterone, the higher your probability of getting prostate cancer. Now, this is really counterintuitive, I acknowledge, because prostate cancer, when you have it, grows faster if you have testosterone. Testosterone acts on a prostate cancer similar to the way estrogen acts on a breast cancer. It generally stimulates cell division and growth. But paradoxically, normal and high normal testosterone levels are associated with a lower incidence of prostate cancer than low levels of testosterone in age-matched cohorts. So I have no idea what the explanation for that is, but that is, in fact, the truth. Speaking of testosterone, research came up a couple of days ago, and we had talked about how when men become fathers, their testosterone levels drop. Well, it looks like men who are fathers are also less likely to die of heart attacks. This study was done by the AARP, and it's looking at 138,000 men. It was a study looking at male fertility and mortality. Well, the higher your testosterone, the more likely you are to have children. Just the fact of having children actually seems to confer a survival benefit. Now, this is just epidemiology. It was published online in the journal Human Reproduction Monday. It does not mean that taking testosterone is going to give you a cardiac benefit. It may or it may not. We don't know that, and there isn't data. Probably there's a sweet spot, as there are with most hormones, where too much, not so good. Too little, not so good. Just right, just right. And there is, in fact, data that too much testosterone or too little testosterone is associated with low HDL levels. HDL is the good cholesterol, so it does make sense that that could create a benefit, depending on which way it's rolling. All right, let's go to one more call before the break, and this is Liz in SoCal. Hello, Liz, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I have a question. I've had long-term pain for 23 years. The doctor suggested trying low-light laser.
Yes.
So I was wondering what you could tell me about it and how effective it is.
Mostly when people say low-light laser, they're referring to some new devices that came out a couple of years ago where little, I guess they're fiber optics using laser, are placed over acupuncture points.
Oh.
So you're effectively doing acupuncture without needles. I saw this device demonstrated 2 years ago at a conference. It struck me that I didn't need to purchase this device because I already know how to do acupuncture.
Right.
It also struck me that it could be a great moneymaker for a practice because essentially it's surrogate income. You buy the device, you can train a technician, a staff member who doesn't have to have an MD and doesn't have to command the salary of a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. They don't have to be licensed at all. And you could just train the person to essentially put this one here, this one here, this one here, and the acupuncture points can be mapped on the individual.
I did acupuncture for, I don't know, probably about 6 or 7 years, and I still have pain.
Right, I know. And so I heard you, and I didn't know about the acupuncture, but I sort of assumed, given that you're calling from SoCal, that, you know,
yeah,
I mean,
you're in
Santa Cruz. You can't walk 2 blocks without tripping over an acupuncturist in this town. Not that that's a bad thing, but it's true. But if acupuncture didn't work, I'm kind of skeptical that low-level lasers will, because they are working the same technology, or so to speak, the same mechanisms. It doesn't hurt to try it. And, you know, you should get a response fairly quickly, and you'll know, you know your pain. You've had it for years, so you're well aware of its characteristics. So, you know, 4 or 5 treatments.
I should be able to tell by then.
I should think so, yes.
Okay, the other question is, I did radiofrequency ablation. And
oh, this must be back pain we're talking about.
Yes, definitely, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And that helped, but it still hasn't cured it. So am I likely at all to receive any help from the low-light laser if the RFA didn't?
The radiofrequency ablation acts by burning the nerve that goes to the place where you're having pain, and the nerve grows back. It's kind of funny. We can't get nerves to grow back when we want them to, but when we don't want them to, they always oblige by growing back. Go figure. In the case of this radiofrequency ablation, it has a duration after which people tend to recur, and it doesn't always work completely because you aren't able to destroy all of the nerves, or because there's a pain driver in the central nervous system at the spinal cord level that's become established. And the way you figure that one out is, does light touch, clothing, light pressure over the pain hurt? And if that happens, then what's happened to that individual is that they have actually created software, I'm going to call it software programming, in their spinal column that takes sensations from non-nerve, neurons, non-pain receptors. So now your temperature receptor and your light touch receptor have literally been hijacked by the pain, and signals from them are being read by this processor, this renegade processor in the spinal column, as pain. And this is something we've been talking about in this program for years, and I just saw a conference. I just got a little card for a conference, you know, new concepts in pain for primary care. And the reason there's a new concept in pain for primary care lecture, by the way, is that there are now drugs, and so you can have money to fund the education. I'm very cynical about this because it's been in the medical literature for decades. I could prove it. You can go back to my show and look at the 2004 interview with Dr. Lawrence Perret, and we're talking about this very phenomenon. But now it's being outreached to me because there's something I can do with my prescription pad, and they want to be sure I know about it. Anyway, I think that in the situation of chronic pain, as new technologies emerge, you're sort of obligated to try them out. Your prognosis, since you didn't do well with acupuncture, is not super, but you never know. And I don't think you should leave any stone unturned. I do think, look into the internet for pain reduction games. There's a couple of really interesting studies. I can't pull the reference right now because it's in my other folder, but there's a burn unit, for example, that published a study where they were using an actual game, visualization game, to help control pain in the burn unit. And they could monitor. They're hooked up to an IV. They have a button they push. So you can monitor exactly how much pain medication a person asks for.
Is it like biofeedback?
It's more like putting yourself into a hypnotic trance with a video game, because, you know, you do trance out when you're doing video games. And this trance actually works like hypnosis to reduce your perception of pain.
Really?
Yeah. And it doesn't just work while you're doing the game. It seems to have persistent effect after you stop playing the game. So,
anybody locally doing anything like that?
Well, you don't need to go local. You can go non-local. You've got the entire web at your disposal. So go seek that out. I would go and search on burn unit video game. You'll probably come up with the name of the game.
Mm-hmm.
If you email me, I've got this sitting in my folder, like I said. So if you email me at askdrdon.com, I'll find the information, the name of the company making the game, and shoot it to you. You want to bet they've got a beta version that you can download for a fee or even for free up online? I sure would.
That sounds great. So it's Burn Unit Video.
Burn Unit Video Game. I would start with that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And let me know how that goes, works for you, okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm going to take a moment and do a brief science lesson because I was so excited to see this article. Those of you who are regular listeners are familiar with the concept of feedback loops, and you're also familiar with the concepts of epigenetics, the idea that it's not just the genome, but how the genome is managed that influences health and disease. Well, this latest research, if it replicates, and I want to emphasize this is one paper, it's very provocative, it needs to replicate in independent labs. If it does, it is another game changer in terms of our understanding of these feedback loops. And would you have predicted it? It makes the whole epigenetics thing even more complicated. Not just methylation of the DNA, not just acetylation of the histones, not just RNA changing whether or not a exon gets transcribed, but the actual messenger RNA, once it's loose in the cell heading for the ribosome to be turned into a protein, well, microRNA, short strands of RNA, can glom onto that messenger RNA and prevent it from being transcribed, essentially wrap it up again so that the ribosome can't read it. And this researcher has shown that microRNA from plants is actually getting into living human cells. I'm not going to go over the technical aspects of how they were able to tell that the microRNA was coming from plants versus humans. This researcher is Chenzu Zhang of Nanjing University in China, and he has been able to show, or at least the preliminary data that it appears, is that plant microRNA from the brassica group, that's your broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, and rice, both get into the bloodstream from the digestive tract, not being broken down fully by the digestive tract, so getting past that permeability barrier. We're talking about RNA. We're not talking about proteins. So it's a good deal smaller and easier to get through. They were able to show that microRNA from these plants actually turned up in the intestines, liver, and spleen. And I'm sorry, this wasn't a human study. This is my study. And they were able to show that bacteria in Japanese people's guts actually have taken genes from ocean bacteria that live on seaweed. So just by eating seaweed, if you have a diet high in that, your gut flora take up microRNA that are not normally present in that gut flora, and that's going to affect genetic transcription. So we have this incredibly and deepeningly complex web of life and feedback loops and multiplicities of scale on which things are having an effect. Diet, I think, is the most neglected form of medicine that there is. And I am very excited to be able to bring you up-to-date information that increasingly convinces you, I hope, that eating a diet high in a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, at the current state of our knowledge, is the best route to health. And despite all of the listeria and salmonella and things that you hear about that, it is extremely important to continue to eat fruits and vegetables. Don't let these outbreaks scare you. The benefit to be derived long-term in terms of cancer prevention, heart disease, wellness, longevity is huge. And we just don't have the details yet because it is so stunningly and overwhelmingly complex. But this one, I think you can take on the evidence right now. It's a good idea. One more little news clipping, which segues on to this, looking at obesity. Recent bit of research looked at what are the foods that are most linked with obesity, and it's French fries. So don't eat French fries. Simple as that. Don't eat French fries. Other forms of potatoes have much less correlation with obesity, but consumption of French fries statistically is a slam dunk. If you want to be fat, eat French fries. Let's go to Ronnie in Salinas. Hello, Ronnie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My wife wanted me to call. She's on the, what is it, the Bioidenticals, I believe it is?
Bioidenticals, I think you mean.
Exactly. And so she's been gaining weight, and she had heard, I think she had read from that Suzanne Summers book about if your levels aren't right, you could gain weight, and she wanted to know if you could recommend someone to help her regulate it.
Okay. Well, I don't like to give out specific recommendations of doctors on the air, but hormone balancing, there are a number of really great people in Santa Cruz area, and I don't know who's in Salinas where you're calling from, but if you Google search hormone balancing Salinas, I'm sure you'll find someone who has that expertise. And I want to caution against, I'm an opponent of what's called the Wiley Protocol, which is what Susan Summers does. I don't think it's a good idea because I think it creates a significant risk for breast cancer. I don't think that we've established that it's safe for women after 50 to be taking doses of hormones that put them at the level of a 25-year-old. I want to put a big red flag over that. That being said, regulating hormones by giving people hormone replacement therapy is a valid way of managing menopausal symptoms. And I want to mention one thing. A study that was done a few years ago looked at women who went through menopause and didn't use hormones, and women who went through menopause and did use hormones, large numbers of both, and they showed more weight gain in the group that did not use hormones than the group that did. When your estrogen drops, your body weight and your metabolism and your physiology shifts. That shift leads to weight gain unless you are eating less and exercising more. And so a behavior shift is required if a woman is not going to gain weight at menopause, whether with or without hormones. You just can't continue on your same diet and exercise pattern and not expect to gain at least a pound a year until probably your 70s. So you have to change your behavior to suit the new endocrine milieu. And as I've said, I don't think I want to trade a slim figure for breast cancer. But I also think that there are ways to avoid both.
Okay. Okay, one more question.
Sure.
For a heat rash, what would you recommend treatment for that?
For heat rash, well, the first thing is to try and keep the area dry and reduce friction. So powder, you know, like baby powder, talcum powder, those are excellent things that are quite helpful. Using a lightweight, breathable fabric, over the area. A lot of times people get this in the groin creases. And there are boxer shorts for men and for women. So that's one strategy. When a person has an area where they've got skin to skin and they're sweating and they're moving, that's the general source of heat rash.
Okay.
So you try to eliminate those factors.
On the neck and on the back.
On the neck and on the back. Get the hair up off the back. Use a breathable fabric. You might try antiperspirant. That could backfire, but just using an antiperspirant, maybe a mild one on the area, can also be very helpful.
Okay.
Okay.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, I am using so many more searches now in medicine. I've become very adept with just, if I'm trying to find something, throw in a few search words. And scholar.google.com is a wonderful, wonderful source for the medical literature, but you have to be able to read medical literature in order to really make it work for you. But I have turned up so many studies on, say, plants and disease, cancer prevention. It's a great way to look for, if somebody's making a claim about a product. I just read one this morning, the stuff that turns flamingos' feathers pink is the world's greatest antioxidant. Okay, great. That's a declarative statement. I'm going to put the name of that chemical in and search and cancer and see what I find and see if there's in fact data that validates this is the greatest thing. Because I've seen, you know, this wave, successive waves of this is the greatest antioxidant and this one has the best ORAC values. Oh yes, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a rare seaweed from Tibet that's going to have the best ORAC values. But, you know, the questions are sustainability and does it really matter if it's got the highest per gram value, if you can consume a higher volume of something that is more sustainable and less expensive, you know, just have more. Let's go to anonymous. We have an anonymous caller.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is piggybacking on to your earlier talk when the woman was asking about the leaky gut and environmental illness. You ran through different protocols that you do.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned you look for mold toxins.
That's right, I do.
Can you say more about that, how you test and then what you do?
I am still learning, so I would emphasize that it's complicated, and I'm not really fully knowledgeable in this subject. It's a big, big topic. But I first of all take a careful history from the patient to look for plausibility. Is there water intrusion in the home? Is there any room in the place that smells moldy?
So given that there would be, and let's just say, is there a couple,
first thing to say about mold toxins is Richie Shoemaker, who is a real expert in this and has written several books that are very accessible to the public, and you can get those books from Amazon. So he has laid out a number of things that I've begun using in my practice, looking for those. These are tests that are available from LabCorp. They cost a couple $100. Probably the most useful one is something called complement split fraction C4a, capital C, numeral 4, little a. And this is a breakdown product of something that's found in the human body. It's part of the human immune system called complement. When it is in a situation where there are mold toxins, it breaks down into this subfragment. So there's a correlation between the presence of mold and this subfragment. There's also a compound called melanocyte stimulating hormone, MSH for short. And this is generally elevated in people who have chronic inflammatory response syndrome as a result of mold toxicity or mold exposure. And I need to emphasize that you can have a negative allergy test for mold and still be suffering from mold-related illness.
Yeah.
And you can also have a normal HSCRP and a normal sed rate. So the dilemma I faced as a primary care doctor when I was only using standard testing was people would come in and I know about inflammation. I'm like, you've got inflammation. You've got aches and pains and gelling phenomena in the morning, and you're testing negative for autoimmune disease, and your sed rate's normal and your HSCRP is normal, but I know there's something wrong with this person. I can see it, and they're not making this stuff up. I always assume that the patient who is in my office paying me good money is probably telling the truth about their experience. My job is to figure out why they're having this experience and is there anything I can do about it, and not to say, well, I can't find anything, you're crazy, go away.
Could you talk about those second part where you just said what you can do about it?
Well, Well, what you can do about it in the case of mold is, first of all, you've got to get yourself out of the moldy environment. And secondly, an off-label use for a bile acid sequestrant called cholestyramine is emerging as a potential therapy for toxin overload, because you can basically get the toxins out of your body. They will bind on to this cholestyramine. So I am not going to try to get into the biochemistry and the stereochemistry of this. I can't barely understand it. I'm not really good at topology and stereochemistry anyway. But Mold Warriors, or his latest book, which is, I think, called Living in a Toxic World or Living in a Mold Toxic World. I'm sorry, I can't remember the title exactly. I would start with that. And there are other tests that are being promoted as ways of screening for toxin-related illnesses. One of them is looking at how well your retina distinguishes between subtle gradations of light. And there's actually a website that will test you on contrast. I think, I'm not so sure how scientific that is or how validated it is, but it's certainly an interesting approach, and it's purported, at least Shoemaker cites it as a way of tracking whether or not you're being successful in freeing the person from the toxins. And it's a cheap test. It's like $1 per test on the internet. So it's not outrageous. Not like a couple of $100 to do the other tests I mentioned, which are blood tests, available, by the way, through LabCorp.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Lee in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My name's Lee. I'm a 66-year-old male. I've been a general contractor for 30 years. I've used my body professionally. The last 10 years, I've been doing the Cybex circuit at the Y to keep myself in tone, as I've become more of a manager than an actual physical laborer in my business. About a month ago, after my Friday workout, somewhere around Sunday or maybe Monday morning, both of my knees just really flared up to the point where it was difficult to walk. And I went in to I get my health care at the Palo Alto VA, and I went in the same day and was lucky enough to get an arthritis physician. And she gave me a cortisone injection in my right knee, and I was able to walk a little bit better. And I coincidentally had some recent x-rays of my knees. And I've got on the inside of both knees, the cartilage space is a lot less, but there is space, than there is on the outside of my knees.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I was given, I think it's tropanol for pain, and told to take arthritis strength Tylenol. And I did that for about a week, and it didn't seem to do much in terms of dealing with my ability to walk, because my greatest problem now is stability. I'll get out of a car, and I have to really stand there for a second. I've never had a knee collapse on me, but there's this sense of it not wanting to be stable.
Mm.
And going downstairs is something that I'm really slow at now.
And it feels, does it feel like you're going to fall?
I no longer go downstairs with my hands in my coat pocket because I like the way my face looks.
Okay, let me just clarify. Going downstairs can be hard because of pain, or it can be hard because you feel unstable. Which is it?
Maybe it's pain, but it makes me feel, this is kind of a cop-out, but I've never felt the knee move around.
Uh-huh. And now
okay. You
do.
No, I don't. I don't. I guess I have to say then it is the pain.
Okay.
I saw the orthopods, and they're going to give me one of these knee braces, the custom-built knee brace with the pin for pivoting, and I can understand the physics of that, of how that can transfer the load around the knee instead of through the knee.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I find interesting is that sometimes I can, like, walk out to get the newspaper, and I'm going, this feels like it's been for the last 65 years. This is normal. What's wrong? Bend down, pick up the newspaper, and hobble back up to the door. And it's like, what? I don't understand how it kind of comes and goes that quickly.
Well, a couple of thoughts.
Okay.
First of all, as the cartilage thins, of course, it becomes more fragile. And when you were doing, I'm sure you were doing some kind of squat press on your Cybex circuit.
And leg presses.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And leg curls.
Right. So the leg presses, you know, those are the ones that can tear the cartilage.
Mm-hmm.
So when a person acutely has pain, you know, so they've got less cartilage on one side than the other, you develop that over years. It hasn't been bothering you. Suddenly it starts bothering you badly enough to go to the doctor. So something happened. Two possibilities. You either inflamed something and got a fire going, like a little forest fire, and now you're in a self-perpetuating inflammatory cascade.
Right.
Or you actually tore the cartilage and the arthritis doctor missed that and you've got a meniscal tear. And that can happen from leg presses. That can happen from twisting. It doesn't necessarily cause a lot of immediate pain if it's small, but it can set up an inflammatory response and it can shift. And that's why the thing you say about you're fine and then you squat and come back up and it hurts, that makes me worry about ligament or cartilage, and that the cartilage is like a little flap. And so the edge comes up and now you've got a lot of pain, and then the edge drops back down and you've got a smooth surface and then the pain goes away. So I'm a little worried about the cartilage being actually torn in you because of the way you're describing your symptoms. Okay. And you're probably not going to find that without an MRI. And it
I have a pacemaker.
It wouldn't matter, because the brace that they've fitted you with would be the therapy. So you would use the brace on a person with a tear at your age anyway. And you would wait a couple of months, and if they did not resolve, then you would go with a arthroscopic surgery to relieve that symptom. You wouldn't change the progress of the arthritis, but you would relieve the symptom.
Okay.
Try the brace for a few months and watch glucosamine sulfate, also a very good idea.
I've been doing that for 10, 15 years.
All right, good.
Yeah.
Got to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.